Today is May 10th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. The Personal Computer Show on WBAI-FM has been preempted this evening for a membership drive. We will not be on WBAI-FM tonight at 9 p.m. And here in New York, I'm in the studio of PRN. This is Hank Key, and let me just give you an overview of what we're going to be covering today. In the first half hour, there's two important pieces of news. One is the everyone's talking about is the seven-year-old CPU flaw in the Intel chip, and everyone's quite alarmed by it. And the other thing is, of course, last week, Microsoft introduced Windows 10S. What is Windows 10S? And in the last half hour, we got some great feature segments for you. We're going to be talking about how do you optimize a Wi-Fi network, and Marty Winston will be doing that. And I'll be covering, if you want to buy a computer system, what are the guidelines that you should be using in the purchase of a new computer system, replacement system, or just an upgrade itself. And finally, Joe Rejeski will continue with his simple computer tip, and he's got a good one tonight. Joe, are you there?
I certainly am, Hank, and I'd like to correct you on something you just said. You said that regarding the Intel chip difficulty, you said everybody was concerned about it.
Well,
yet when I mentioned it to you to cover tonight, I wanted us to discuss it tonight, you said, but it doesn't affect anybody. And I said, but the headlines, they're screaming, the world is coming to an end.
Well, you know, like Henny Penny, a leaf fell and the sky is falling, and well, you know, they're running around saying the sky is falling, and I'm saying, hey, you know, in Extreme Tech, they're saying major Intel security flaw is more serious than first thought. Or from ZDNet, they're saying Intel chip vulnerability lets hackers easily hijack fleets of PCs. And everything you need to know about Intel's scary security flaw from Mashable. You know what?
But one thing they left out of all of those headlines, Hank Key says, what?
Well, no, I said, really? Really, with a big question mark.
Yes, you did.
And what are they correct in what they said? Well, yes, there is a vulnerability, but it's like anything else. You have to not just tell half the story. The first half of the story is there is a vulnerability, but the second half is, but what chip does this affect? And I drilled down further. And what it is, it's a family of architecture that uses the Intel vPro CPU concept. Now, the vPro, V-P-R-O CPU, is not a CPU. It's the architecture that includes three hardware factors in it. And how many people have it? Well, you know what I did? I went to Intel. I went to their website. I went to the CERTS government site. Joe, why don't you tell people what CERTS stands for?
Well, CERT has been around as long as we've had problems. It stands for the Computer Emergency. Originally, it stood for the Computer Emergency Response Team, but now it stands for the Computer Emergency something else team.
Readiness team.
Basically, readiness team.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what it is when something like this comes up that supposedly is affecting the entire concept of computing, these guys, originally based at what was the university, Hank, out in Pennsylvania?
UPenn.
No, not UPenn. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But this team would jump in and see if they could analyze not only what the problem was, but how to react to the problem so that the country wasn't left at the mercy of the headline writers. It has a website, cert.gov.
No, it's us-cert.gov.
And if you go there, you'll find some fascinating stories over the whole history of it. They keep everything there. But the current one, which is Hank was talking about, is up there. So it is a serious problem.
Yes,
Hank,
it is.
Who does it affect?
Well, first of all, it affects the CPU that has built into the CPU three pieces of hardware to it. And two of them is probably foreign to most people. What they're saying is that this does not affect the consumer product at all. And in fact, it affects a very small percentage of the products, very small. And how do you know whether you're affected or not? Very simple. One of the things with this concept is that the Intel Ethernet connection, all right, is built into the CPU itself. It's not an extra chip on the motherboard itself. So if you happen to have something that is not Intel to run to be on the internet, then you don't have the chip at all. And it also has to be a 1 gigabit speed adapter to it. And
there is, Hank, there's one thing I'd like to add that is actually up on the Intel Security Center site, mm-hmm. which says, I feel it's very, very important that we read this. This vulnerability does not exist on Intel-based consumer PCs
yes.
with consumer firmware. Now, if that is the statement that Intel put on their Security Center, don't you think that should have been mentioned in all of these headline stories?
But you know what? It doesn't make for interesting reading at all, okay? Now, there's one other thing that I want to point out is that they also said that this vulnerability first of all, if you happen to be upgrading your BIOS, it could be affected. Well, if you don't upgrade the BIOS, it cannot be affected. And the thing that affects is remote access control communications, which very, you know, when you have to combine all those factors in, it's virtually no one, because since 2007 till now, no one has reported being hacked with this vulnerability. But the fact that this so-called vulnerability exists because of the way it's structured, you get these headlines saying, wow, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And Joe, I just wish that, I don't want to call it fake news because what they are saying is true, but they got to give out the rest of it. And I hate to have people listen to us and say, hey, we got this big problem. What do we do? The answer is, don't worry about it. You can go to sleep.
Hank, you used a phrase that is stinks so, so terribly misused these days for various reasons. Fake news, I have to define for the folks in case they don't realize what it is. Fake news is a story that's made up of whole cloth. It's not based on truth, and there's no truth within it. It's a phrase that's used by politicians, for politicians, about politicians. But now I'd like to correct something that I said just a few minutes ago. What Hank said, well, what does CERT mean? And CERT is part of the Software Engineering Institute, which is a federally funded research and development center operated by the Carnegie Mellon University for the federal government. The Carnegie Mellon University was the first CERT site and is still the headquarters of CERT, which is a government function, but it's run by SEI, the Software Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon. And if you know anybody involved out there, it's an absolutely fascinating operation.
Mm-hmm. And my apologies for saying UPenn. I knew that they were either University of Pittsburgh, University of Pennsylvania, or Carnegie Mellon, and I just got the wrong one.
Well, we used to have a very dear friend whose brother still is at UPenn and has been involved in computers as well as linguistics.
The other thing is that last week we had commented, because it was a breaking story, that the Chromebooks have had a major impact. And we were talking about how it had a big, tremendous growth, and that they had a 58% penetration in the education market. And that was one report. And then the other report that came out during this past week was that the non-education market, in other words, the consumer market, the enterprise market itself, also a big major a growth of 16%. And I looked at the numbers, I combined them. I was surprised that there were about somewhere around 16 to 17 million units out of 270 million units sold last year were Chromebooks. That's huge. In other words, the number of non-education Chromebooks sold was equal to what was sold in the education market. Because the education market is smaller, you hear 58%. But 16% is quite a bit. And I looked at it, and I in response to that, what Microsoft did was they said that, you know, they're coming up with five new machines using Windows 10S. And to me, I said, okay, they stripped down Windows 10, and let me see what they stripped down. And I was shocked. They did not strip down Windows 10 to come up with Windows 10S. Most people would think that, you go from home premium to pro to enterprise to ultimate, you know, whatever the fancy words are, you know, for the day for Microsoft. And I wish they were more like Google and Apple, where it's an operating system, OS X, or the Chrome operating system. But Microsoft breaks up in little parts. It turns out that Windows 10S is not a subset of Windows 10 Home Premium at all. In fact, it's slightly under it's really Windows 10 Pro with a couple restrictions put in for security reasons. Other than that, it's really a Windows 10 Pro with making it tightly controlled. Like, for instance,
well, I always wondered why they called it S, Hank. I assumed it was 10 subset S.
Yeah, I know.
Or stripped, but now I realize it's S stands for schools.
Yes, it stands for schools, and it turns out that a lot of the enterprises are looking at it and saying, hey, we're going to use it because it has a full capability of the pro version. And like, for instance, one of the things that I think is going to be very useful, if you happen to be the administrator for an enterprise organization, is that when you install a program, it has to be part of, it has to come from the Microsoft Store. Or if you happen to be enterprise, you can write applications that can, you know, come off the Microsoft Store and only for you. And what it is that it's a certification of programs that's accepted and passed, and it gets into the store. And, you know, so this way...
Hank, I think you should explain for a second, at least, what do you mean by the Microsoft Store? Is that a brick-and-mortar place over on Fifth Avenue?
No. It's a cloud-based inventory of applications, of which many of them are free. Some of them are at cost. Like,
it's something like the Apple App Store.
Yes. There's one difference, though, with it is that Microsoft, free is free, whereas with the Apple Store, they get a cut on whatever is, whatever revenues there are. I think it's at 30 or 35%, something like that.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So what it is that I'll give you, for instance, what is in the Microsoft Store is Office 365. In other words, the Office product is cloud-based, and they charge something like $5, $6 a month. You know, it's software as a system, and that's a new way of how they market it now. So what
some people have said that that's the future of software, renting it by the month.
Well, it started with Adobe, and they were very successful with it, and it's going to be continued. Everyone's going to end up doing it. And the good thing about it, from a positive point of view, is that, you know, ransomware will have a tough time getting through because they can't modify, you know, you got to install a you got to bring in a program to modify the data to, you know, make it ransomware, and that would not pass certification. So that is a very positive thing. Viruses would also be restricted. What's negative about it? Well, that means that certain things will have to pass certification before it gets accepted. And you may say, gee, I want it, but I don't have it. Now, Google also has certification. And one of the things I said to myself was, okay, let me take a second or third look at the Chromebook. On the first look at Chromebook, I had two objections to it. One was printing. It's cloud-based printing, and you have to go to a cloud printer, and that really hasn't changed. They did come up with instructions of one paragraph on how to set it up. I said to myself, for the average person, you got to be kidding me. You got to do more than, you know, four lines, one paragraph to set up a cloud printer.
Does the paragraph explain it sufficiently?
For me, yes. For you,
okay.
No.
Now, do I have to buy any special equipment? Or I have two printers here at home, one for the office. Do I need anything special for printing, or can I just print?
No. You have to. Number one is that the printer has to be compliant with a cloud definition of a cloud printer. In other words, if you happen to have a...
what you're telling me really is that I can buy a $200 computer, but then I have to back it up with a $500 printer.
Well, one of the things that Google has stated is that, hey, we're moving very rapidly to a paperless society, so why are you so concerned?
I'll tell you why I'm so concerned. I just came out of the bathroom. And I don't want a paperless
too much information,
society.
Joe. Too much information, all right? Now, the other thing I looked at was, okay... one of the things that we always talk about is that when you buy a computer, you don't buy an operating system. You buy hardware, but what you're really doing is you're buying a solution to something you want to do. In other words, it's application driven. And I'll give you an example. If you happen to be in a doctor's office, have you noticed that they have these dedicated applications? It's called vertical applications, and it does one thing. It could be an X-ray display of your tooth, or you ran through a CAT scan or MRI, and it's showing up, and that's all it does. It doesn't do anything else, and those applications are considered vertical, and not a problem at all. However, if I look at the Chromebook, for the average user, what I did was I tried. The first time I looked at Google Docs, it was really wanting. But now I took a second and third look at Google Docs, and I said to myself, let me give it a try. I took a 14-page document that was created with Microsoft Word, and I just brought it in right into Google Docs and tried to do edit on it. It's not 100%. The navigation is different, and if cost is a factor, I think for most people they can use Google Docs, but if you're currently a Microsoft Word user, it does require a re-education process.
Okay, let me put in my two cents first, because just now at the beginning of the show, you had sent me an outline for tonight's show, or at least all the news items, and mm-hmm. that was backed up on it.
Right.
So I opened that up. And I clicked on it, and it asked me, did I want to open it up in Google Docs, or did I want to download it, and then I could do other things with it. I said, no, open it in Google Docs. It opened up. I have it here in front of me. If I want to make an adjustment to it, I can add a comment. I can't change the text, but I can add a comment to the text. I find it absolutely usable in every way. I'm not a heavy user of Microsoft Word. I don't use all these macros and special features of it. I use it as a basic word processor. That's all I need in my work, in my life. I'm very satisfied with that. What I'm not satisfied with because I can't print it out.
Oh, no. Well, the thing is, once you can get that cloud printer to work the way you want it. Now, by the way, there's a way of getting around it. And you probably heard that HP has these e-printers.
Yes.
You send it as email, and it goes out to the printer.
If you have the printer.
If you have the printer, okay.
But now, I have two printers, none of which will accept that.
Well, let me put it this way.
The reason I wanted a Chromebook, it was a very inexpensive addition to my my battery of tools. But it's not very inexpensive at all.
Well, let me put it this way, Joe. If you can, you can use legacy printers, but let's say you went through the trouble of setting up and it works, all right? But the thing is, and then I asked myself, well, the average user that is not using it in a vertical application, like, you know, a dentist's office or a doctor's office, but, you know, you're a regular home user and you got to do some documentation, you got to do some minor spreadsheet work, and maybe that's about all you do. But what else does the average person, home user, does, okay? Well, there are two, three products I can think of. One is TurboTax. Nope. I said, okay, there's no TurboTax with a Chromebook. All right, what other tax prep programs are there? Answers, none. Now, you can go to the cloud to do your taxes, but if you do anything other than a 1040 EZ, you need a regular prep program. Okay, suppose you have your accountant do the taxes for you. All right, what else might you want to have? Quicken. Nope, there's no Quicken. So these are the things that you really have to ask yourself is, you know, basically, what do you really need? And if it's not available, what are some of the workarounds, and is it acceptable? But you know what? I you know, it's like in the last 5 years with the introduction of the Chromebook, it's sneaking up there, and I would predict that in another 5 years, it will probably be a sufficient repertoire of applications that can satisfy most users. And at the price, by the way, in some of the newspapers, they're talking about Chromebooks selling for $200. You can get it for $150 today. It's pretty cheap. And I think it's one thing I like about it is that if I get a phone call right now, someone is a Windows user. Oh, I got a blue screen of death, or I how do I do this, and so on. And I try to talk them through it. By the way, with Windows 10S, what they're saying is, hey, it's similar to a Chromebook. You can bring it back to, you know, factory reset very quickly. And I think that's the direction we're going in. So what do you think, Joe? You think you're going to buy a Chromebook one day?
That computer for email, browsing the web, and the other things that are on the web, and all of the problems that I relate to on a Chromebook, they never come across. They don't have to print things. They might be an easy thing if they did, but they're so used to using their cell phones, they don't have a printer on that, so they found their own work.
Well, talking about a cell phone, you know, there was a news item that came out, and I'm saying, huh? I can't believe it. Now, the headline itself is no big deal, okay? They say that we've now hit the tipping point where more than half of the households in the United States, more than half, do not have a landline. They're using the mobile phones. And I'm looking at this survey, and it's done by the Center for Disease Control. And I'm saying, wait a minute. The Center for Disease Control doing a survey on what phones are using, whether landlines or mobile? And I was kind of surprised by that. It turns out that every year, part of your tax dollars goes to the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control, so they can interview 40,000 households, and this is part of the National Health Interview Survey that they do. And part of the information they got is this, and it's not surprising at all that a great percentage of those that only have mobile phones and not landlines are at the poverty level, or that, you know.
That surprises me.
Really?
Everything else, I was following along with you, nodding my head, yes, yes, yes. That surprises me. I can go out and get a landline for $11 a month, and I can get a phone for about $1.98, and that's it. Now, you're telling me at the poverty level they're getting cell phones.
Yes.
Even with the prepaid cell phone, I was in a Verizon store. They're now selling prepaid cell phones. The prepaid, I'm still, even though it's not much per call, I'm still having to shell out $40 at a time to get the first phone.
You're surprised by that, huh?
I'm shocked.
Okay, and another piece of news is that 70% of millennials do not have a landline.
70% of millennials don't talk on the phone.
Oh, no, they have a mobile phone.
Yeah, but they text, they don't talk.
Oh, you're saying they're using for texting?
Yeah, and for research and for browsing. And for... I get on the elevator in the morning at about, you know, it varies between 7:30, 8:30, and the elevator is always full of, in my building at least, millennials. And they all get on the elevator, look at me, and shake their head. They don't say good morning, but they nod their head, good morning. And they're plugged into their cell phones. Most of them, I've been doing a survey, I would say well over 75% are iPhones. And they're texting, and they're reading, and they're going about their business, which they wouldn't do if they were talking on a cell phone. You can't have an elevator crowded full of people doing a conversation. These people don't talk. They text.
Well, you know, there was a joke on TV, and it wasn't really a joke because I've seen cases of it where they show two people dining in a restaurant, and they're looking at each other, and they're smiling and nodding, and they're texting to each other instead of talking to each other.
Well, that might be a little bit of an overstatement, Hank.
But I've actually seen it, though. I couldn't believe it.
No, but I've sat in a restaurant and seen two millennials texting, but not to each other. They could have been sitting with perfect strangers. They were texting other. And I was out at my brother-in-law's over Easter, and he and his daughter-in-law and somebody else at the table, after they waited for the whole meal, but while we were waiting for coffee and dessert to be served, they whipped out their cell phones, and they started doing it. And I turned to him, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, I was just bored. I'm doing a crossword puzzle." And I turned, I'm not using names intentionally, and I turned to her and said, "What are you doing?" She said, "Oh, I'm answering some email." And the third one was just texting somebody. And I don't want to say I'm old, but
you
obviously
are old. You are old.
Obviously, I'm so old that that kind of behavior would have been considered very impolite in my day. And it would have been as if at waiting for dessert, everybody got up and went to a different table until the waitress came back with the dessert. I don't know. I don't understand. Hank, I am old. I don't relate to this behavior. I'm curious. You know, the folks who are listening to the show are of all different ages. Write to us at PCRadioshow.org, joe@PCRadioshow.org, or just PCRadio at PCRadioshow.org. Tell us what you think about it. I just find it bizarre behavior. I really do.
Okay, Joe. Well, as promised, we're going to go to the second half of the show. And Marty Winston really did a really it's kind of technical, but I think it's worthwhile listening. If you have any questions, just let us know, and we'll try to answer them. On optimizing a Wi-Fi internet reception, a lot of people don't realize that you can get a little more speed out of it, and depending how many users there are. And I give a little segment about, you know, modified guidelines if you want to buy a computer, because the computer has changed. It's not what you think it is. And Joe Rejeski has a great something that I knew about, but most people don't think about. But you'll see what it is when it comes to sending email, and you'll be surprised. So let's get to it. And now from Marty Winston, a dissertation on how to optimize your Wi-Fi internet setup.
Mm-hmm. I have a channel challenge, and yes, it relates to the 40-year house. 40yearhouse.com talks about that project. This is not like swimming the English Channel. It's not like 500 TV channels and nothing you really want to watch. This channel challenge is all about Wi-Fi. And let me explain why Wi-Fi has challenges for all of us. Then I'll get into how we've made it even worse. If you're not living in the middle of a large lot, in the middle of a sparse neighborhood, your neighbors probably have Wi-Fi. If your Wi-Fi is the original low band, like 802.11a or b, you have a total of 11 channels. Worldwide, there are only 14 channels, 11 in the U.S., and they are not with lots of bandwidth. They are pretty good because they're 2.4 gigahertz instead of 5 gigahertz. They're pretty good at range. You'll get good range out of it, but you won't get huge bandwidth. And because of that, those lower channels are still a viable thing that a lot of people want to keep. It's a question of coverage. Are you going to get any signal at all at the corner of the house? With only 11 channels to choose from, you know, the experts say, choose 1, 6, or 11, whichever one your neighbors aren't using. Good luck finding one that isn't being used. It doesn't take you long to scan them, but don't worry about it. Just you'll figure out if all you can use is low band, you'll figure out how to connect to low band, and you'll be there, assuming, you know, low band is the signal strength and the bandwidth you need. There's also a 5 gigahertz high band. 802.11ac is the best, and that's an evolving thing. Now, high band is defined differently. High band accommodates many trade-offs between the channel bandwidth and the number of channels you can have. I've heard of experiments with actually gigabit bandwidth on 802.11ac in the high band. That doesn't mean you have gear that's going to handle that, but the gear has been tested, and they're working on it. There are two other ranges we won't talk about today because you can't get at them. A lot of the concern about channels is making sure you have a clear one, but wait, it might be double that. If you use a range extender, it's really a repeater. It's picking up one channel where your access point is creating it and becoming a relay access point on a different channel. You've now just used twice as many channels. If it's on the low band, boy, are you greedy. Boy, are you hogging it. On the high band, different kind of thing, you might be able to make it work, but of course each repeater has less range because it's 5 gigahertz instead of 2.4, and the same amount of power doesn't go as far. We got that figured out? Okay. You know, it's like the person who can only whisper being asked to pass it on. You know how that works. So let's deal with why anybody would go low band if you get all those extra channels on high band other than the range. I hope this doesn't insult anybody. It's about grandfathering. Really, in this case, it means accommodating older equipment that was built before high band was available, or less expensive equipment that may not implement high band. It's really always going to be better if you can make everything work in high band. Have I made that clear? Not quite the range, more bandwidth, more flexibility, more channels available, more likely to work for you. But if you need low band, how are you going to figure that in? How are you going to make that extra range work? What are you going to do? What are your compromises? And I don't want to go too deep into that, except for you to know there's this whole spate of questions that goes around Wi-Fi. And if all you have is older equipment, oh boy, for you, it's a question of getting to the gear you have. For me, it's more complicated. Some of the sensors, some of the gear I have to connect requires low-band Wi-Fi. Now, this is for the 40-year house. It's on a 5-acre lot. It's sparse out there. We're not going to have mutual interference among us. So that will work pretty well. High-band is going to be more of a challenge, but with repeaters, we can do it. The complicated factor is that we're going to have more than one LAN needing Wi-Fi. Dual WANs come in, one connected to fiber, one connected to cable. Dual WANs become at least two and possibly as many as six local area networks, each a separate gigabit network. One of those is for production PCs. One of those is a guest network. One of those is for the control system. One of those is for the surveillance cameras. One of those may be for streaming content, and one we don't know yet. That's a lot of separate networks. Do each of them need wireless? Depends on the gear. Are the TV sets wired Ethernet? Everything that's wired Ethernet is taking itself out of the running for being a problem for Wi-Fi. And as much as possible, we're dealing with wired Ethernet. And if you know me, you know I'm not beyond hacking to make other things compatible one way or another. How many of these things are going to need Wi-Fi? That's one of the things we're looking at. On the surveillance network so far, I think we can implement it with zero Wi-Fi cameras. I think we can make wired Ethernet work everywhere. That saves me channels. That absolutely saves me channels. On the guest network, if we're going to be cordial to our guests, we have to provide both high band and low band. And we have to provide it everywhere. That's multiple access points, multiple channels. On the production PCs, we may cut a break. We have new enough gear that the production stuff can all happen on high band. And don't discount those little dongle adapters that put high band Wi-Fi onto, for example, older notebooks that only have native low band. Getting out of low band, getting into high band is a good thing. It'll help you. It'll not handle the range. You know, we've been over that. But a repeater on high band will, and that is a good way to go. Also, look up MU-MIMO, MU-MIMO. Check the wiki on that. Learn how that works. It can help you somewhat on high band stuff. You don't want to have to go into the commercial, small business, industrial kinds of networking gear. They have a whole different spate that they're solving, and the technology needed to solve that is beyond what you need to be paying for to handle it at home or in a very small office. I will tell you, planning, implementing, involves hard decisions. It's like deciding which one of the very attractive triplets you want to date before you've gotten to know any of them very well. But know that low band 2.4 gigahertz, A, B, G networking in Wi-Fi has a limited number of channels, that your neighbors are going to be using some of them, that your own gear is or maybe using more than one channel each, and that is a narrowing wedge of challenge that you're going to have to face. You also have the challenge of backing it up. So the advice is, everywhere you can, go high band. If you need to adapt high band with repeaters, do it and forget about it. And as the technology improves and higher band Wi-Fi, those AC adaptations, become available, don't jump. Give them 6 months or a year before you get to them. It will become a lot more affordable. It will become better performing. It will become more reliable, and it will become less challenging. But don't forget to back up your Wi-Fi by having a spare access point or router handy. Also, one last point. The Wi-Fi that comes native with cable modems or fiber modems or what have you, delivering content and internet to your house, tend not to have the same range, tend not to modulate quite as well as some of the off-the-shelf products. You may want to consider configuring to turn off the native Wi-Fi in those devices and plug in your own instead. You always then have that native Wi-Fi as, ready, Hank, as a backup. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. Shopping for a computer system. You are interested in buying a new computer system, and it may be your first system, or a replacement system, or just another system. It isn't the purpose of this segment to tell you what exact model to buy, but simply to provide a guideline what you should look for where you should be looking and what to avoid. If you're not interested in laying down significant hundreds of dollars for the latest and most complete feature system, then you shouldn't expect the purchase system to be the fastest full-feature system. I read the reviews written on many products, and I'm constantly amazed on how some people will trash a product based on specs and not actually having purchased or used the product. Another is when reviewers complain of a lack of limitations or in features. Why then did they buy it in the first place? May is college graduation month, and June is the time for high school graduation. You may want to gift a family member with a personal computer. What type of personal computer should you buy? This is a question that's often asked. First, you have to ask, how will it be functionally used? In the case of a student starting their first year in college, what the college is recommending and supporting. You don't go to a car dealership to find out if you need a sedan or SUV or a truck. You know already when you go to the car dealership exactly what type of car you're going to buy. You also have a budget range on what you can afford. Otherwise, it's just window shopping. There are basically desktop or laptop systems to choose from. If you need portability or mobility of the unit, the obvious choice is the notebook. If you need a large viewing monitor, you may opt for a desktop system. But you may have a real estate problem on your desk, but you really want the large size monitor, and you may want to have that mobility of the unit to use. The all-in-one desktop may very well be the solution. The monitor and the system units are integrated into one housing unit. The notebook platform makes up for over 70% of installed systems. The notebook can easily be transported from one location to the next. This simplifies making available the system for assistance in hardware maintenance or upgrade. The separate component parts of a desktop is advantageous in terms of component testing and replacement. Replacing just the monitor is far less costly than replacing the LCD screen of a notebook. Try to be able to examine the model unit you're interested in before the actual purchase. With notebooks, there is a traditional clamshell platform. Now, there is a two-in-one in which the system unit portion of the notebook can be folded under and be used as a tablet. A variation of this is the ability to detach the keyboard portion of the unit, as the screen portion of the notebook also houses the computing unit. Today, both desktop and notebook systems are offered with the option of a touchscreen. If you need it, or if you want it, it will cost $100 and up, additional to the unit. With larger screen notebooks of 15-inch or more, they are offered with a separate numeric keypad as part of the keyboard. Another nice-to-have feature is the lit keyboard option. It makes for easier keyboard use when the LIN is dimly lit. Then there is a variation in connector ports. VGA and HDMI display ports vary. You need to know whether or not the equipment comes equipped with the standard or micro connectors. Newer budget notebooks don't have the hardwire RJ45 Ethernet port. The number of USB connector ports will be a factor in your system selection. There's the USB 2.0, USB 3.1, and USB-C ports. On very low-cost budget systems, there may be just one or two USB ports. You may have planned to use a wireless mouse, a Bluetooth speaker, and a USB flash or external hard disk drive. You will need to do some dongle or cable juggling to do this. The problem is there are far fewer brick and mortar computer stores than there used to be in the past, but that doesn't mean that shopping for a computer system the old-fashioned way is without merit. If you're fortunate enough to live in a town that still has a real computer store, well, that's great. First, it's worth noting that differences in cost between traditional and online retailers often doesn't exist anymore. Over the past few years, computer manufacturers have been selling direct and have adjusted pricing policies for all authorized dealers, meaning most of the time a computer will cost the same online as it does in a physical store. However, this isn't necessarily true of accessories. Physical stores offer the one thing that internet retailers cannot provide, and that's the hands-on experience. Especially when shopping for your first computer, getting a feel for different brands and models is imperative. often what leads someone to prefer one computer over another doesn't have anything to do with the specification, but rather that's something that can't be put in words. It's the touch and feel and the ergonomics. Are the controls laid out in an intuitive way? All these questions can easily be answered by spending a few minutes in a store, whereas even hours of online research may not provide the necessary information you're looking for. However, there will be limits in what you can compare in a store. Most brick and mortar shops can't compete with online retailers when it comes to a large selection. Again, with so many makes and models out there, there simply isn't room for many stores to stock every desktop and notebook system. Also, if you don't live in a major city, there's a good chance the internet is your only remaining option. The only thing to watch out for are bundled accessories. Now, in the case of manufacturer bundles, there's nothing to worry about. What we are talking about here are retail bundles. To be sure, retailers will often attempt to woo customers with bundle discounts that are totally legitimate, but the devil is in the details. If an offer includes a discounted accessory with the computer purchase, check to see if it's a name brand item or not, or from a third party. Third party accessories aren't necessarily a red flag. Many will work just fine, but don't be fooled into thinking that you're saving $50 or more when you're really just buying a cheaper product at its normal price. Before making any hardware purchase, identify what application programs you will install on the computing platform. Don't assume the application you need is available to run on any hardware system you choose. Form follows function. When in doubt, visit the website of the publisher for information on minimum platform and operating system requirements. Hopefully, these tips will help you make a more informed buying decision. It's a jungle out there.
You're not emailing Word files, are you? Well, if so, on this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People, I'll tell you why that may be a big mistake, my friend. One time a client had contacted me because they were experiencing issues emailing a proposal in a Microsoft Word format to a prospect. The Word document was only a few pages long and had a few pictures, but the file size was huge, far too big to be sent via email. Due to the file size, the proposal was repeatedly rejected by the prospect's email system, thankfully. As part of a troubleshooting effort, I enabled the version history, and lo and behold, there before my eyes was every single change ever made to that document over the years. This was no ordinary document. This document was essentially a template the company used to create proposals for prospective clients. Every pricing change, every revision of language, references to other clients and prospects, many, many, many pictures that came and went. They were all embedded in this gargantuan document. Why? Well, it seemed that somehow track changes had been enabled, probably by mistake on this document, thereby giving every recipient the potential to see all prior versions. Think about it. Imagine your prospects receiving a proposal from you, allowing them to review the names and pricing of everyone else who had received a similar proposal from you. Embarrassing. Microsoft Word is a great application for many a word processing standard. A similar issue can occur with other applications, which is why when you are sending out documents, just turn them into a PDF. Turning your documents into a PDF will lock it down and not retain the history of revisions. Another reason to do the Word to PDF shuffle is your Word document on another computer may not show up as beautifully formatted as it appeared on your computer. Maybe the recipient doesn't have one of those special fonts you used, so your document will be rendered with a replacement font, and that doesn't quite work. If your document is sent as a PDF, what you see is what you get. When you're ready to convert your Word document to a PDF, just select File, and then Save As, and select PDF or XPS. Make sure Save As type indicates PDF, obviously. If for some reason you have an earlier version of Microsoft Word or you are working with another word processing application that doesn't save files as PDFs, then try the free application Qt PDF Writer. Just go to www.qtpdf.com. Since the application is free, please be aware of the subtle options to install other applications when you're installing QPDF Writer. You probably don't want them. QPDF will create a printer called QPDF Writer. When you're ready to convert your file into a PDF, just print it to the QPDF Writer and the application will ask you where to save the PDF. Simple. So whether you're sending a proposal, a resume, or a love letter, create the document in your favorite word processor, but transform it into a PDF before sending it on its way. There you go. That's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Try this tip now and you'll never forget it. Did you like this tip or do you have a computer tip for me? Let me know. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rujewski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe. Public service announcements. The New York Amateur Computer Club is having its meeting Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is how to self-publish e-books, audiobooks, and paperback books. Meeting will be held at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 405 in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, May 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology Old Westbury Campus, located on Northern Boulevard and Valentine Lane. They meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, May 23rd, 7 p.m. in the community room at the Princeton Public Library, Princeton, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on iPad and smartphone, Together at Last, Thursday, May 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Meeting will be held at Middletown Library Lodge Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PCs Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, June 1st, 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, Room number 101 in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their general meeting on Friday, June the 2nd. Starting time is 8 p.m. They will meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad located on 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on video and still camera technology on Tuesday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, June the 13th. Meeting time starts at 7:15 p.m. They meet at the Rasser Room of the Palisades Mall on the fourth floor, located at West Nyack, New York. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on smartphone ride services. Thursday, June 15th, 2 p.m., meeting at the Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is pcradioshow.org. And we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.